again, brothers, sisters, in the Lord Jesus Christ. It's very good to be here with you this morning. Today we have as our subject Ezekiel 38, primarily. We also, God willing, intend to talk about the sequence of events in chapters 37 through 39. And then, God willing, tomorrow deal more in detail on Ezekiel 39. But this chapter today, actually these last three chapters of these restoration prophecies are really full of a lot of drama and intensity. And of course, Ezekiel 38 is, it's a frequent subject of classes and talks and lectures, and I'm sure we've got students in here. Everybody's looked at this chapter. Dallas has studied it. And so, with that introduction, I want to put up an outline first. So this is a suggested outline, and this is from Brother Mansfield. I happen to like it because it makes it easy to remember. He uses he's to kind of where we can memorize this chapter and outline this chapter. And I think it's helpful when we've got our Bibles open and we're looking at this chapter. But we have verses 1 to 7. The people, 8 to 12, the plan, verse 13, the protest, 14 to 16, the period, and then 17 to 23, the purpose. And, we might think about, that first section we had to go to and host outline, and that confederacy, who will make up that confederacy. And then in those next set of verses, we have this plan, and you could probably summarize that in verse 12, where it was to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn his hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited. And then verse 13, the protest again, and then verses 14 to 16, we learn that it is in the latter days. We learn that in verse 16. And then in verse, the purpose, this is probably the most important section, and I'll just read verse 23. This is the purpose. Thus will I sanctify myself I will magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. So this is the grand purpose of this particular, we'll say climax of the ages. Okay, but this outline is from Brother H.P. Mansfield. I cannot take credit for that. But to start off, let's just read the first three verses together. So if you would come with me to Ezekiel 38, we'll just read the first three verses. And the word of Yahweh came to me saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. So right off the bat, we have this, and this is another, we've talked about some dominant phrases in the book of Ezekiel. Here we have another one. We haven't really spoken to it yet. But the word of Yahweh came unto me saying, and we see that some 50 times in this prophecy, in those particular form of words, and really there's more that are in similar forms. Similar expressions. But what is impressed upon the prophet and us is that what is to follow will most certainly come to pass. We can place the utmost confidence in what follows with a full assurance of faith. And then we have these titles we've already discussed. Son of Man. We all understand the significance of that. Then we have that title of Sovereignty that we see there in verse 3, the Lord Yahweh, he who will be ruler. And so what we see develop in this chapter, in this climax of the ages, we see this name and this title of Yahweh become a reality in the earth. So, one more point I would make is that we have this term Gog there in verse 2 introduced. So what is Gog? Who's Gog? What does that name mean? I'll just mention briefly that the name signifies a roof or the one at the top. the roof, or one at the top. So kind of just keep that in your, in the back of your mind to go through this. So I want to put a summary of the chapter up. I thought this was a really good and concise summary of the chapter that we might go over together. And this is in that set of verse-by-verse notes on Ezekiel's prophecy of the restoration. And I'll read it. It may be kind of hard to see from back there, but I'll read it. Having revealed the purpose of Yahweh to completely restore Israel, the prophet now outlines the means whereby this will be accomplished. The people must be humble before they will be elevated. They will be subjected to such political pressure as will force them to seek their God. The devastating invasion of the Holy Land portrayed in the chapter now before us will accomplish that. Yahweh will use that Russian Gog as he previously used the Assyrian in Isaiah 10 to humble his people, reduce them to a state in which they will be forced to turn to him whom they've ignored so long. But it will not only be Israel that will be humbled by this crisis, but all nations. And that's, I emphasize that there. It's an important, also an important component of this. The violence of the Russian attack will sweep the Western powers aside, and with Israel prostrate before Gog, it will seem as though the whole world is about to fall before his power. And then this last sentence is most important, and I'll read it. Divine intervention alone will save the world from this ruthless conqueror. So, essentially, Yahweh is merciful. And in this act of intervention in the affairs of man, essentially, it's a merciful act by Yahweh. So, keep that in mind. Okay. To start off, let's look over at Ezekiel 38:17. I want you to just kind of think about this verse as we go through this chapter. Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them? So that verse is in the form of a question. I think this is a very key verse when we come to study this chapter. So, the events that we see in this chapter are not just now introduced by Ezekiel into the scriptural record. And I just want to bring a couple of examples to your attention. And I put a few up here. Now, there's more that could be added, but these are a few that... So, you know, we run back to... You know, think about it as Exodus 17. The war with Amalek. And some of those events that transpired there. As a matter of fact, keep your hand in it. Let's just go back there. Keep your hand in Ezekiel 38. Let's look at Exodus 17. Just read a couple of verses. Kind of a refresher here. And I'll read 13 to 16. Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And Yahweh said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, Yeshua. For I will utterly put out a remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. We read the rest of the chapter there, you know, that because of this, to commemorate this, there was an altar built. And also, Yahweh said there will be war with Amalek from generation to generation. So, Amalek, we don't read him in words in this chapter. He was led by Agag. Agag was a title of the king of the Amalekites. Agag is just really another form of Gog. So, Joshua is introduced here to destroy the Agag, the Agagite, the Gogite of the Amalekites. And then, another example, let's go over to Numbers 24. Look at a couple of verses there. And read a little bit about Balaam, the reluctant prophet. And let's just read verses 5 through 7. You know, Balaam has this vision of Israel in glory. How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel, as the valleys are they spread forth, as gardens by the riverside, and the trees of Lion Lowe's, which Yahweh hath planted, and as cedar trees beside the waters. He shall pour out pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. So here we have, you know, Agag is Gog in the Septuagint. You know, Balaam is a significant figure in the Bible. He never really leaves the narrative. We read about him all the way over in the Apocalypse. But he, as we know, he beheld Israel here in glory. And Israel, this seed would be higher than Agag, higher than Gog. So I just wanted to bring you, so that, and if, you know, you also might go over to verse 18, you read verse 18, this kingdom will be exalted over Edom. We read in verse 18, and Edom shall be a possession, Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies, and Israel shall be, shall do valiantly. You know, we dealt with Edom and Mount Seir the other day. Okay. Next, we would mention Agag. He appears again in 1 Samuel 15. Remember the story. I'll just read verse 8. Saul was told to go destroy the Amalekites utterly. That was his instruction. Leave nothing breathing. He didn't do that. He was rejected, consequently. And we read in verse 8, he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Shouldn't have done that. But then we come over to verse 33. Actually, I'll read 32 with it. Then said Samuel, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came unto him delicately, and Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. What did Samuel do, that gentle prophet? He hewed Agag into pieces. Well, why would Samuel do that? Well, he knew that Gog, or Agag, was the great enemy of Israel. And he did exactly what the Lord Jesus Christ will do later. Okay, so we can take this a little bit further. Who was the bitter enemy of the Jews in the day of Esther?
Haman.
He was an Agagite. He was a Gogite, wasn't he? And he was a bitter, inveterate enemy of the Jews. And he was destroyed in his own trap, wasn't he? He built this scaffold thinking to destroy the Jew, destroy Mordecai on it. But he ended up on that, didn't he? It's just like Gog in the latter days. Gog will lay that trap. They think they will come down into the land of Israel to destroy Israel. But they themselves will be destroyed in that trap, they said. They will fall in those mountains of Israel. Another one probably worth mentioning here is Samson and the multitude on the roof. So if we go over to Ezekiel 39, verse 11, we read this term, Haman Gog. So this valley where Gog's slain will be deposited is called Haman Gog. And it means the multitude of Gog. Remember, Gog means the roof. So that kind of makes us, you know, I think we may think of Samson. How did he destroy the Philistines there at his death? There was a multitude of them on the roof. And he exerted his last bit of strength to bring down that roof and to destroy them. Which is, I believe, figurative of what we're going to read about here today. And then I put a few more up here, and this could be added to. We have Genesis 14. We have Armageddon, you know, and seen there in shadow and type. We have the Gideon, and that's referred to later as this Gogian conflict, as the day of Gideon, where the Midianites destroyed each other down to the ground. That's what Gog does. We have the Assyrian invasion as a type in 2 Kings 18. You know, we've already talked a little bit about David's victory over Goliath. It's also a typical. I've gotten moved against there. And I meant to edit that out. But basically, the point is that, you know, if you're in Ezekiel 38, we see where in verse 3 it says, behold, I am against thee, O Gog. So really that, it's not so much as just the setting of space against Gog, but it implies action moving towards Gog to destroy Gog. Well, and the reason I put that there on David, remember what David did with Goliath? What did he do? Did he wait on Goliath to come to him? No, he didn't. He ran to Goliath to destroy him. He moved against Goliath to destroy him. And if, for an interesting study you might want to take to yourself is go look at these types of this Gog and conflict and then look at the various situations where they move against the enemy in shadow of type. And then we have, you know, I believe also we have the political fulfillment of Genesis 3:15. And then there's many more we could add to this. So I put a map up here of the territory of the people that will make up the, this Gogian host. And we've already mentioned who is Gog, what does that name mean? It means, just kind of keep that in your mind, the one at the top. And geographically, he's the one at the top, if you look at the map here. And I believe actually this territory that is demonstrated here, I think it really is a more comprehensive than what is seen here. You've probably seen a map like this or similar to this, if not even this one. But here's the thing to keep in mind. I think it actually covers more of Africa, and I think it goes much further to the east than this map would depict. And the point being is it's a vast territory. It's a huge amount of territory and a huge confederacy that will exist. Okay. I'm gonna take a little bit of a different approach this morning. I have an advantage because I have a room full of Bible students that have all studied this and know this. And I could spend a couple of classes going through and identifying these names and territories and so forth, but you all know that. I'm sure there's many brothers who could get up here and present this better than I could. So, and this information has been in our community since 1849, and I think since the death of Brother Thomas and others, there's even been more historical evidence come to light that I think demonstrates the truth of this, the geographical extent of this Gogian Confederacy. Now, there is an interesting quote that Brother Thomas puts in, this is an exposition of Daniel. It's on page 86. I think this is notable. Actually, if you want to go read, I'll give you some page numbers, 81 to 84 in Exposition of Daniel. Brother Thomas actually goes into more detail on the territories and some of the historical information that he does and helps this one. But this quote is good. He says, and the name of this section is called The Future Magnitude of Gog's Dominion. By turning to a map of Europe and Asia, the reader may trace out the territory of the Kingdom of Babylon as it is destined to exist in its last form under the King of the North and his Gogian manifestation. The names of the countries furnished by Ezekiel will lead you to a just conception of its general extent. Besides all the Russias, it will take you to Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Prussia, Austria. So that's pretty much Europe, the European continent proper. Turkey, Persia, Tartary, Greece, the Roman Africa, and Egypt. This will be a dominion of great magnitude, extending from the North Sea to the Wall of China and Afghanistan, from the Ice Sea to the deserts of Africa and Arabia. Now, he has one name up here that's not real familiar. We don't use it a lot in this time, and it's Tartary. So Tartary, if you look that up, is a name used from the Middle Ages until the 20th century to designate a great tract of northern and central Asia. So we can see how that would push this territorial magnitude would go much further to the east, encompassing, well, to the Great Wall of China, encompassing modern-day China, from the Caspian Sea and the Urals to the Pacific Ocean. So the Urals are a mountain range that run from north to south in western Russia. Of course, you know, the North Sea is the sea between Britain and Germany. And it's actually sometimes referred to as the German Ocean. But anyway, just kind of keep think about that, the vastness of this magnitude, or the magnitude of God's dominion. It is and the earth has never seen anything like it. Daniel calls it dreadful and terrible. Okay, Rosh is the ancient name of Russia, and I think everybody understands that. There's one scholar from the 19th century that made this interesting observation. I forgot to write his name down. But he said that Rosh, most of the translations, I read the King James, most of them say the prince of Rosh, Meshach and Tubal. It's translated chief prince. Most all the other translations translate correctly. Rosh is a proper name. It's the ancient name of Russia. But this scholar wrote that this was the only name of a modern nation in the Old Testament, Rosh. Well, that may have been correct in the 19th century when he wrote that, but it's no longer correct now. There's another name of a modern nation in that chapter 38, isn't there? And that's the nation of Israel, the mountains of Israel. So, in Rosh, we have the serpent power politically manifested in the age to come. The word Rosh itself signifies head or poison. And this is the head of the wicked that is to be crushed. If you would turn back with me to Psalm 68, there's a reference I want to look at. Psalm 68, which... this is a messianic, apocalyptic psalm. I have another in my Bible, The March of the Caravan. We want to look at verse 21. And this is another example of he whom I have spoken of in all the time. Ezekiel 38, 7. This is another chapter we could have gone to. But verse 21. But God shall wound the head of his enemies and the hairy scalp of such an one that goeth on stealing his trespasses. So this, I think here we have a reference to, reference to the head or the rush, the one that would be crushed by the Lord Jesus Christ or Yahweh through the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's very, very interesting. In this verse, we have this term rush or the head, and it's said to have a hairy scalp. Notice that. The hairy scalp of such a one that goeth on still in his trespasses. Well, that... Hairy is the word Sear, Seer, Edom. So we have here evidence of the Edomite characteristic of this Rosh, or this head. And there's also a significant statement over in Habakkuk. Let's go to Habakkuk 3. And I'll read verse 13. This is a chapter that speaks, this is another chapter you could call it, The March of the Caravan. Verse 13, thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for salvation with thine anointed. Here's the multitudinous Christ. Thou woundest the head, the Rosh, out of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation unto the neck. Selah. So here, the word is translated head. Doubtless it is properly translated here. But anyway, we can see the link to this Rosh in chapter 38. So a couple of points I put up here. This Rosh, this Strong 7218, it signifies a poisonous head in the Hebrew. As such, a manifestation of the serpent power in Eden, a synonym for sin. It's a sin power. And in Job 20:16, it's translated poison, venom, and Deuteronomy 32:33, gall, in 29:18, 32:32. It's interesting to go look at these words and see how they're used. We won't take the time to do it right now, but it's very good. So, if we back over to Ezekiel 38, if we look at verse 4, let's read verse 4 together. And I will turn thee back, and I'll put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth in all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. and I will turn thee back and bring thee forth. Now, the Revised Version renders back as about, or I will turn thee about. I will turn thee about to fulfill the purpose that I have in mind for you, even Yahweh says. That seems to be the idea expressed in this particular verse. Jesenius renders it, I will lead thee away enticingly. So Yahweh is going to bring Gog into that land for his purpose. This is because he's going to capture Gog in this trap and destroy him. You know, and there's similar language that Yahweh uses to address Sennacherib in Isaiah 37, verse 29. Let's turn that up. Isaiah 37, 29, where we read, because thy rage against me and thy tumult has come up into mine ears, therefore I will put my hook in thy nose and my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way that thou camest. So in Sennacherib, we have a blasphemous Jew hater. He's kind of like Haman. He's also like Gog. Of course, we know what happened to Sennacherib. His forces were destroyed right outside of the walls of Jerusalem. The same thing's going to happen to Gog in that very same place, in the walls outside of that same city. But the point being is that Gog is controlled by a power far mightier than himself. Yahweh will take Gog and lead him where he will. And it is into the land of Israel, because it will be, you know, for his purpose, which we read about there in the 23rd verse, Ezekiel 38. Another interesting feature of verse 4, back over in Ezekiel 38, is, see that phrase there, even a great company. Even a great company. Now, in this verse, this word company is an important word, I believe. It's a Hebrew word, which is really the equivalent of the Greek word ecclesia. Therefore, it signifies a company gathered together by invitation for a special purpose. And again, we might think back to, you know, Acts 15:14, where there's the ecclesia is a people who are called out for the name. Well, this is an entirely different purpose here. We turn over to the third chapter of Joel. Let's go to Joel 3. And we look at, I think we see here in Joel 3, we see that invitation that will call out those people, that ecclesia of flesh. And look at verse 9. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them draw near. Let them come up. So there's this ecclesia of flesh that will be assembled. Beat your plowshares in the swords and your pruning hooks in the spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Now here's a call. This is an invitation for the Gentiles to prepare war. And as a result of this call or invitation, there's a great political ecclesia of the flesh that will be formed, only to be destroyed by the ecclesia of the spirit. So this is, in a sense, we can look at Gog. We looked at that map. This Gogian ecclesia of flesh is taken out of all nations. Likewise, you know, the true ecclesia of God is redeemed out of all nations. You know, I have a reference here. Revelation 5:9, if you want to write that down. The ecclesia of God is the people are redeemed out of all nations. So here we have this Gogian host, and the instruction, and this is kind of an irony, is be thou prepared and prepare thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee. And so this ecclesia of flesh is going to be destroyed. Now, if we look over verses 8 to 12, you know, this part of this chapter is very interesting. Well, you know, all of it's interesting. It's all very interesting, but the word may be overused. But prayerfully, you know, these events that are going to transpire that will involve us. Ultimately, that's our hope, that we're there in that ecclesia of spirit in that day. Now, I believe verse 8 particularly, after many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years, thou shalt come back into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many peoples. out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which will always be waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. So I believe here we have a, you know, here we have the period. We have the prophetic timetable, the latter days. And so think about that just a minute. So today, what's today? July the 4th, 2024. It's a notable day in the history of this nation, July the 4th, 2024. So where are we at this particular point in time as far as Bible prophecy is concerned? And especially in this particular chapter that we're looking at here this morning. So I've got a diagram I want to put up here and talk to a little bit. First of all, I want to give credit. I did not conceive this diagram. I copied it off of a brother that delivered an address on this online. And I thought he depicted very well the sequence, so I borrowed it from him. I've got his name if you want to come ask me about it. So Ezekiel 38, Judah in the land in unbelief. So there's a box there. This is where we are now. So there's a line drawn down through that box that denotes Judah in the land in unbelief. And then we see Ezekiel 38 listed there in the middle bar. At the top, we have Ezekiel 37. As you can see, and at the bottom, we have Ezekiel 39. Now, chapter 37, which we, you know, did a kind of a summary of with you yesterday, as the diagram points out, really belongs after the events of chapter 38. And that may sound a little strange to some of you. Maybe you haven't heard that, but let me attempt to explain it. I mean, I think we spoke to that some yesterday. But clearly, Armageddon occurs in chapter 38. Where that great host comes down against Israel and is destroyed by Yahweh. If we just look back at chapter 37, verse 7, we talked about it yesterday somewhat. You know, as Ezekiel prophesied, and as I was commanded, as I prophesied, there was a noise, behold, a shaking, and the bones came together, bone to his bone. So Ezekiel prophesied as he was commanded, and there was a noise, which I believe it's a reference to Armageddon, and behold, the shaking and the bones came together, bone to bone. We mentioned that yesterday. Now, that passage is a parallel passage, which you can see on the screen, to Ezekiel 38, verse 19. If you look at chapter 38, verse 19, if we look over there, we read, "For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken, surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel." You know, it continues there in verse 20. There at the end of verse 20. "All the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground." Shaking. Now, it's notable that the very same word is used here in verse 19 of Ezekiel 38 as is used in verse 7 of Ezekiel 37. And it's not a common word. It's a fairly uncommon Hebrew word. So there should be a great shaking in the land of Israel. Now, I believe this is a reference to that, you know, enormous literal earthquake that will take place and destroy God. And that's what we read over there in verse 7 of chapter 37. And it causes bone to come to bone. And as a contrast, over in Ezekiel 38, Gog's bones are scattered to the four winds. It takes 7 years to find them all. There's some other interesting contrasts there as well. But anyway, at this point, then chapter 39 becomes the context of what happened as a result of Armageddon. So if we read over in verse 6 of chapter 39, we read, "And I will send a fire on Magog, and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles, and they shall know that I am Yahweh." There's that phrase again. They will know that I am Yahweh. Notice there's no Gog here in verse 6. He will send a fire upon Magog, which I believe really has to do with Central Europe. Gog is gone. Gog is destroyed by the time we get to that point. So we have Yahweh's judgments on the nation of Europe in that verse 6 there. Now, we see, if you look at the first five verses of chapter 39, we see that Gog is destroyed. In verse 2, there's a reference to a sixth part, and that's how it's translated in the King James. Bullinger notes this about that sixth. He says, it's more properly rendered, and I will lead thee on. Some of you may have a translation that indicates that. The word, it's almost like it was a transcription error because the word six and the word to lead are very close to Hebrew. As a matter of fact, Rotherham in verse 2 translates that, therefore, this is in chapter 39, therefore will I turn thee about and lead thee on and cause thee to come up out of the remote parts of the north and will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel. So go will be, as we noted, will be led into a trap, kind of like Haman. He's going to be kind of like Haman. Gog is completely destroyed. His power to wage war is completely destroyed. But when you read verse 3, now we're kind of jumped to 39 chapter. But in verse 3, Ezekiel 39, his bow and his arrows are smitten out of his hand, so he's completely lost any power to wage war. What is indicated there. I will send the fire, this is verse 6, I will send the fire on Magog and among them dwell carelessly in the isles, and that isles can be rendered remote coastlands. I believe this really encompasses as Yahweh's judgments spread out, they will encompass the entire earth. You know, U.S., Europe, Australia, everywhere. And they shall know that I am Yahweh. We read verse 23 of Ezekiel 38 already. This is the grand purpose of this conflict. He will be magnified, he will be sanctified among the nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. So after Armageddon, there's going to be further extensive judgments. Now, time won't really permit us to consider this, but I've got a reference up here for you to Revelation chapter 14, verse 20, which is the vintage of the earth. So in Revelation chapter 4, we have more information on Armageddon and this vintage of the earth, post-Armageddon. So when we look at this, you know, we can see that really, the way, and you could take this and expand it to all of these restoration prophecies. This is just the final three chapters, because we have pictures of the end in some of the other restoration prophecies, don't we? The plantation to the name, the David, the one, the shepherd prince ruling over them, and so forth. So this could be expanded, but you know, it's like a divine jigsaw puzzle when we piece all these prophecies together in a sequence, and everything fits perfectly. And you know, you might be thinking, well, I've heard Ezekiel 37 deals with the return of Israel. Well, it does. It has to do with the return of Israel in its full understanding, in its fullness, as the prophecy requires. We've already, you know, I would direct you to look at, you know, reread Ezekiel 39, verse 25. We read it yesterday. I'm going to read it again right now. But, you know, this is Yahweh's people. And while they are dwelling, you know, now he will restore the house of Israel. But at the current time, they're dwelling in trespass and sin. You know, and we noted yesterday, Israel does not know God today. They are not before Yahweh in true understanding. But after Armageddon, they will, and from that day and forward. You know, it says that in Ezekiel 39. And from that day and forward, they shall know that I am Yahweh. All this read, this is the 23 and 24, chapter 39. In And the heathen shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them and gave them into the hand of their enemies. So fell they all by the sword. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions have I done unto them, and hid my face from them. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, now will I bring, after Gog is destroyed, after Armageddon, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob, and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel. There's that phrase from chapter 37, verse 11. The whole house of Israel will be jealous for my holy name. Okay. See if we can wrap this up with the time allotted. So, this is a diagram. This is a time, this is kind of a descriptive of that diagram. Let me just go through this with you. And this, like I said, this is inclusive of the 37th to 39 chapters. This could be expanded, and you could start back to chapter 33 and larger on this. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make it a project. But anyway, chapters 37, 1 through 6. A vision of Israel restored. Israel is not restored. It's a vision of Israel restored. 38, 1 through 7. A description of Gog's armies that invades the land of Israel. 38, 8 to 13. Gog invades Israel. 38, 14 to 16. God's purpose with Gog. 17 to 23, the presence of Yahweh will be felt in the earth. In chapter 39, 1 to 16, the burial of Gog's army. 39, 17 to 21, the great sacrificial feast. God invites the nations to come and see. 39, 22 to 29, Israel's full restoration, a 40-year process. 37, 7 to 10, the resurrection of the Valley of Dry Bones. See how we go back to chapter 37, the whole house of Israel restored. 11 through 14, the revival of the whole house of Israel, 40 years. And then the result, a transformed nation, a transformed land, a transformed people, a transformed government, and the David, the greater David as a shepherd prince will rule among them, and the saints as co-rulers. And then chapters 40 through 48, it's details the house of prayer for all nations, the millennial temple, and the glory, the return of the glory. I want to read to you we spent a little bit of time on that, talking about that timeline. I want to put to you a quote that I'm sure you're familiar with. It's worth reading again now. What Brother Thomas wrote, and I believe this is talking really about Ezekiel 38, verse 8. This is from Elks Israel. There is then a partial primary restoration of Jews before the manifestation, before Christ returns, which is to serve as the nucleus or basis of future operations in the restoration of the rest of the tribes after he has appeared in his kingdom. The pre-eventual colonization of Palestine will be on purely political principles, and Jewish colonists will return in unbelief of the Messiahship of Jesus and of the truth as it is in him, as they will immigrate thither as agriculturalists and traders in the hope of ultimately establishing their commonwealth, but more immediately of getting rich in silver and gold by commerce with India and cattle and goods by the industry at home under the efficient protection of the British power. That's Ezekiel 38:8, I believe. Now, Brother Thomas wrote that in 1848. That was 100 years before Israel became a nation. Think about that. Now, Brother Thomas understood that from prophecy. How did he understand that? He understood it from the prophets. We too also can understand that, I believe, from the prophets. So let's just kind of talk about an overall theme of these chapters and closing this, you know, wrapping this particular class up. So really it's the climax of the ages. This is the great climax of the ages. This is the smiting of the image on the feet. The image begins to crumble. The kingdom of God is set up and continues, you know, and like we have read this morning to us in Isaiah 9, the increase of his government will know no end. So we have this latter-day conflict between flesh and spirit. The Russian gold will be the greatest combination of power ever seen in the hands of men. The greatest battle the world has ever seen. Flesh will be no match for divine power manifested by Christ and his saints. Flesh will stretch forth its hands to defile Yahweh's land and Yahweh's people, and they will be destroyed. Flesh will be humbled and overthrown by the wrath and judgment of the Lord Yahweh. Now, I want to close this up on a personal note because, you know, as our brother expressed this morning, you know, we think about, I think when we have a firm picture in our minds of what is to happen, and we have this before us, you know, always before us mentally, you know, we're going to be better prepared in that day. And we will be a more fit servant to help and assist in that end, in that day. Now, Brother Thomas wrote there's the verse that we're in Peter that says, judgment shall begin at the house of God. So we need to always have that in our mind. We're going to go to the judgment seat before all this happens. Yahweh is planning ahead, and he will have his bride in that day prepared to destroy Haman. So he wrote and I didn't write down the year, he wrote this is in the Old Herald, and I'll have to find the year. But he had an article, it's quite good. It's called Seven Signs We're in the Time of the End. He wrote this back in the 1850s. It could have been written last week. It's just as valid. But the very last one he said was sign seven. And this is interesting, isn't it? The sign seven, a sign that we're in the time of the end, is the preparation of the bride. Now, note what he said. At the crisis of the marriage, she, the bride of Christ, is said to have made herself ready. And that doing so clothes herself with righteous deeds. This implies that previous to the marriage, she had been engaged in dressing her lamps and filling her vessels with a store of oil. This dressing her lamps and filling her vessels then becomes a sign that the celebration of the nuptials is at hand. It has been given to her to know this. And knowing it from the signs of the times, she's been enabled to discern. She's making herself ready for the event. This preparation of the woman, then, is the seventh sign of the times, which may be easily discerned by enlightened faith. So here, brethren, you know, Yahweh has given us, he's condescended and stooped down to tell us what he's going to do before he does it. He's given us the ability to discern these signs of the times. You know, October the 7th was a wake-up call. It was a wake-up call for the ecclesia. It's an act of mercy. Yahweh is shaking us awake and saying, look what I'm fixing to do in the earth. So the bride is making herself ready. This is a sign of the times. Are we making ourselves ready? You know, I hope we are. I think we are. We need to prepare for the nuptials. Anyway, that'll conclude our class today. So God willing, tomorrow we will consider Ezekiel 39 in a little bit more detail. Thank you.